Cultivating Place is made possible in part through the generosity of the Caddo Shaw Foundation. This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. As we enter seed sowing and plant planting season in earnest, I think we as gardeners are more aware than ever of the material costs of our passion and pursuit known as gardening. As pony and six-pack containers, to say nothing of black and green plastic one-gallon pots, pile up in our utility areas, our garages, our landfills. This materiality and its persistence in our lives is all too visible. In a few cases, there is circularity, the ability to return pots to nurseries who will repot and use them and keep them in the loop. But all too often, due to very reasonable hygiene and pathogen concerns or capacity concerns of storage and staff, this is a one-way street of plastic byproducts dead-ending at us or our local landfills. A smaller footprint, an alternate and more intimate route with our plant relationships is among the many beautiful reasons to start smaller and slower, to garden from seed to shining seed. But here too, in the seed sector of this business end of garden and plant love, we gardeners perpetuate the plastic, petroleum-based world we have grown accustomed to this past 100 years or so. But there have always been other ways. We just have to look for them, see them, reinvent them, or innovate them. This is what this week's guest, gardener, inventor, designer, and small business owner Anne Fletcher realized she needed to do if she wanted to redesign her own garden life without the plastic consequences and long-term costs of those. She literally went to ground, using technologies of the past and the present to rethink and reimagine the present and the future. Her Orta Kitchen Garden ceramic self-watering seedling trays are the beautiful result. In our ongoing exploration of who gardeners are, where gardeners are, and what they're growing in this world, I am so pleased to welcome you, Anne, to Cultivating Place.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
I would love to have you introduce yourself a little more specifically to our listeners. Give us your sort of 2-minute elevator pitch on who is Anne Fletcher and Orta Gardens, and why is this important in our world right now, Anne?
So I'm Anne Fletcher. I am the founder of Orta Gardens. It's a company that started in order to sell a self-watering seed pot that I invented about 10 years ago and has grown over the years really into a seed starting entity. It's a business, but it's also an advocacy group at this point to help people just learn how to start seeds themselves. So from the very beginners to just, how do you succeed? How do you get from that packet of seeds to the plants that you want? We still make self-watering seed pots. That's kind of our main day-to-day activity. They're ceramic pots, and we make them here in Berkeley, California. So a lot of my life is just quality control and making pots and shipping things. And also a big part of what I do is education and a newsletter talking about seeds and seed starting and how to do it and why it's important. And I work with small seed growers too, all around the country, to bring unusual and very high quality seeds to home gardeners so that you can get more diversity, more kind of robust varieties that you're not going to get at your typical big box stores. So it started with kind of chemistry and engineering and building stuff. And now it's very much about connecting with seeds and seed growers and gardeners all over the country.
Beautiful. We are going to unpack so much more of this because this work you are doing really taps into the intersection of so much that's important in our horticultural space and world right now in really interesting and innovative ways that I think will be of great interest to listeners. But before we go into that, take us back a little bit. Who were the people and places and plants that grew you into a woman for whom marrying your environmental interests, your engineering interests, and your entrepreneurial interests would all would be a driver for you? Where were you born and raised, and who were the people and places and plants that grew you, Anne?
Oh, wow. Okay. So I'm old enough that it's kind of a long story. I grew up in Berkeley, California, you know, insert hippie jokes here. And I've always been just very connected to the outdoors. I think I was born that way to a certain degree. My mom tells stories about when I was a baby that if I was fussy, she would just put me on the porch and I would be quiet. And at one point she even was doing the dishes and realized she put me out in a snowstorm when we were living in the East Coast for a little while. And I was perfectly happy. You know, she would bring me inside and I would cry and she put me out in a snowstorm and I would be fine. So I think I've kind of always had that. And both of my parents gardened. I remember we had raspberries when I was a kid and I loved them. My grandfather was a gardener. He'd grown up on a farm. And by the time I was a kid, he was definitely not a farmer anymore. But in the summers, we would visit and he always had a vegetable garden. And for him, it was serious business. You know, it was gardening for dinner and chickens were for eggs. And you know, I was given the chore often to go get the lettuce or go get the dill to make a salad. And so I had a sense of that kind of rhythm of plants. But the truth is, it wasn't a very deeply plant upbringing because I grew up in the city. But I guess I was just always connected to the outdoors. And as a teenager and as a young adult, I just wanted to be in the mountains all the time and ended up living in Chile for a few years, almost 5 years, where I basically saved up my money and went there to go skiing and just be in the mountains and ended up running a tour guiding business and a campground for a while. And then eventually got into the surfing industry in Chile, where I was running a company making accessories for just the surfing world in Chile, living on the beach. You know, living the dream of a 25-year-old. And that was when I had like a real epiphany, because I don't know how much you know about the kind of surfing and outdoor tech, but most backpacks or technical fabrics, they're all basically made from plastic. You know, it's nylon with PVC coatings or polyester and urethane. And so we tried our best to not waste these materials. So, you know, with the big offcuts, we would make smaller products until we were like making little tiny wallets out of like the little offcuts. But eventually you have scraps that you just can't use. And I was taking out these two garbage bags full of basically plastic scraps in this tiny town kind of on the coast of a pretty small country. And it was hot. It was kind of a dirt road. It was dusty. And I'm just kind of looking around and thinking like, I am so insignificant. And look at what I'm producing. Like, and it just hit me. It was just insane. Like, oh my God, my tiny little impact here running this tiny little company that barely supports four people is causing this much plastic.
And it's horrifying, right? I mean, it's a horrifying gut punch.
It was. It was just, and that was, I think, the moment for me that like my connection to being in the outdoors, being in the ocean and being in the mountains kind of clicked with my professional life of like, I can't both be this involved. Like literally when you're in the ocean and surfing, you know, you're in the water and the water is in you. I can't do both of these things at the same time. And so I returned to the US and went to graduate school to study product design with the express purpose of how do I make these materials cleaner?
Really? Yeah, that's so great. Where did you go?
I went to Stanford to the product design program that has since become the D School.
Okay, yep.
And it became really clear, like within half of a quarter of being there, that the problem is not materials. The materials, clean materials exist and have existed for a very long time. You know, all the technology is there to not destroy the environment and has been, and it only is getting better. The problem is in our perceptions and in the way we design the world around us, in the way we consume, and in the way business is done.
Yes. Especially this last one, right? Especially this last one.
Mm-hmm. I went into school with the idea that I was going to study materials because as an undergraduate, I studied chemistry and biology. I'm a technical person. So it was kind of like, oh, I'm going to solve this technical problem. But it's not a technical problem. So I kind of zoomed back out and refocused on studying design ethnography, which is studying what people want and how do you design kind of for needs and wants and how do you affect change in a more behavioral way. Then I spent many years doing that as a consultant and teaching design ethnography at Stanford. And again, I got back into this problem of there's plastic everywhere. And the only, not the only, but often the companies that would hire somebody like me are companies that make disposable plastics or various other products and services that were pretty directly opposed to my values, like the whole reason I went to school in the first place. And so I just made a conscious decision in about 2010 that I was going to start a business that was actually going to do some good. I was going to not just be using good materials, but I was also going to be trying to work on the behavioral side, trying to help people develop their own connection with nature. And that's where Orta came from. And funnily enough, it actually started as a drip irrigation business because I was thinking, you know, if I can help people water and save water, that's better. But the truth is drip irrigation, first of all, there's no way around a lot of plastic. And second of all, nobody likes drip irrigation, right? You try and talk to somebody about it. And people would be like, you know, I'd explain how it was going to work. And I had this whole system to like make it easy and easier to maintain. And it wasn't going to get holes in it. And everybody would kind of be like, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. There's right? a very, very small group of people in the world that are really animated by drip irrigation. And let me say that those people who are animated by it are really animated by it. But it is a select group.
Exactly. And I'm kind of one of those. I'm kind of nerdy that way. But I could see, even with my somewhat naive business mind, because that's not my talent in the world, really, I could see that that wasn't going to fly. And at the time, I was still working as a consultant. I was traveling a lot, and I was killing my seedlings over and over again every time I would go away, right? Because seedlings need to be watered once a day, at least sometimes twice a day if it gets hot. And I would go away for 2 days and come home, and my precious seedlings would just be dead. So many times. I can't tell you how many times I lost a whole batch
of
seedlings.
Yeah. It's a devastating moment. Yeah.
It is. And it just kept happening. So I started making all these like kludge together contraptions that would keep them alive while I was gone. And they were, you know, like old pots and like wicks with ropes. And I mean, they were so ugly, but they would kind of keep things going. And after a while, I decided, you know, I want a prettier one of these. And I need a material that can be both non-porous, like to hold the water so it doesn't, you know, leak out everywhere, but porous so that it can kind of wick.
So I want to go back to this idea, this sort of dilemma you were stuck in as a materials designer. Like once you realized this issue with the plastics being produced by the surfing industry with the waste, even when you tried to not make as much waste as possible, there was still a lot of waste and it was still all plastic based. This also comes back, my remark right here, to my emphasizing the way we do business. Because the fact is, we as a consumer culture have been sold over and over again this ethos of convenience and cost savings for us as drivers to what we value. And so as a result, cheaply produced with poorly paid and cared for labor and poorly cared for land across the globe has led to this proliferation of disposable plastic-based objects, from saran wrap to our surfing suits to our seedling trays. And the horticultural world, as we know, is rife with this problem of so much plastic as a result of again, what you focused on, these perceptions of what is clean, what is lightweight, what is shippable, what is disposable, what is convenient. And if we're ever going to make a dent in this problem, we can't just design better plastic. We have to switch our mindset and come up to the moment where you've clearly already had the catalyst, the germination moment of, I want to do this work now, and develop a seedling tray that overcomes all of these obstacles I've encountered. How do you come up with that first ceramic self-watering pot? And once you tell us that story, I will ask you to actually describe them for us.
Okay, sure. You know, it's funny, that part was almost the easiest part of everything. I took a sabbatical from my consulting work. I mean, sabbatical, it was freelance. I just didn't schedule anything, but I kind of had saved enough that I could go a month without any projects. And so it was a month of October. So I scheduled my last presentation for one project on like the end of September, and the next one didn't start till the beginning of November. So I had a whole month, and I took pottery classes because I knew nothing about ceramics. I'd never done pottery except like as a kid. And so I went to a pottery studio every day and took pottery classes, and I learned to throw, you know, pots on the wheel and mugs. And I'm really quite bad at that. But, you know, I just kind of learned about the material and the glazes and started learning about forming clay in different ways that isn't just circles on a wheel. And because of my engineering design background, I've actually done a fair amount of casting, like metal casting and making molds. So the process for making these pots comes from, it's a process called slip casting, where you use plaster molds to make a form. And so basically what I did is I started by making a positive form, which I carved, and I decided to make the first one with six pockets in it because plants usually come in six packs. It just seemed sensible. It wasn't a particularly considered choice, but it seemed kind of like a good size. So I carved the original pot. I made a mold in my garage, and I started with buying prepared slip casting clay. So it's just like a liquid about the consistency of a milkshake.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you basically, you pour it into the mold, and then you pour it back out after a little while, and it makes a hollow shell. And I remember calling the people I'd bought the clay from, because I poured it and then I would open the mold and then the thing would tear. I'd be like, well, why is it all sticking and tearing? What's going on here? And so I called them and said, well, how long do I wait to pull it out? And they said, oh, you know, till it's about right. Just welcome to the ceramics world. You wait until things are about right. I said, well, how hard should it be? And they said, about cheese hard.
Okay.
I was like, cheese? Well, what kind of cheese? You know, are we talking Parmesan or Brie? There's a lot of cheese.
Right, right. Farmer's cheese? What?
What cheese are we talking about here? Like, you know, cheese. So anyway, but it only took, honestly, you know, a few weeks of just kind of tinkering, of figuring out which kind of cheese, which, by the way, cheddar, more or less, okay, is about what you're after.
Okay.
For the budding slip casters out there. And so then I made with my one mold, probably, I don't know, a dozen or so pots. And I took them to where I was taking these pottery classes to use the kilns. And when they came out of the kiln, my other pottery students, kind of my colleagues there, were saying, oh, well, that is so cute. What is it? I want one. And I was like, aha. Because at the time I was still working on drip irrigation. I was only making these pots for me.
Right.
And I was like, there is zero energy in drip irrigation. But with pots, these people aren't even gardeners necessarily, but they're cute. Like
they are cute too.
The light bulb went off, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, if it's cute, you've got a way in, you know, you've got the beginning of something. And so from there, I made more molds. I kind of figured out how to kind of make more of them. I did a Kickstarter to get some money to kind of keep going, and little by little moved from, you know, firing at a communal pottery class to having a little studio of my own. For a while, it was just in my garage. And, you know, little by little, we've built up to having a bigger capacity to make these more consistently. From everything, now we like make all of our own clay.
Anne Fletcher is the owner, founder, and inventor behind Orta Kitchen Gardens ceramic self-watering seed trays, and their California-based brick and mortar, as well as their online shop and seed club. We'll be right back after a quick break to hear more about Anne's inventive and entrepreneurial garden life story. Stay with us. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by the Caddo Shaw Foundation, funding initiatives that empower women and help preserve the planet through the intersection of environmental advocacy, social justice, and creativity. Hey, it's Jennifer. There is nothing quite like seeding and germination and seedlings growing exponentially every day on the windowsill or in the greenhouse or even in the ground to remind us of the power of a seed, the strength of our plants, and the miracle of plant life all around us. Tender and yet tenacious. It gets me every time. Every single season, and every single seed. Right now, my zinnia seedlings are a daily marvel in the sunroom windowsill. We're back now to our conversation with Anne Fletcher of Orta Kitchen Gardens. Orta means kitchen garden in Italian, and the ideal of homegrown produce starting from seed was the imaginative germination point for Anne's invention and design of a non-toxic, ceramic, self-watering seed tray. As we come back, Anne describes the deep pleasure of growing plants from seed, of slowing down and being more present and intentional as a result.
And that's been the beauty of it for me is slowing down and having that relationship, because I'm very much an instant gratification person. You know, I love to have an idea and do it right. Now. In fact, I was diagnosed with ADHD only about a year ago as an adult, and it makes a lot of sense. You know, I kind of want to do it right now, right. But I love this relationship with seeds over time. It's become a whole new dimension to life. And like you said, the varieties, that was the thing that got me in the first place, is that I desperately wanted Thai basil because I love it. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, when I was starting out as a gardener, you couldn't buy it as a seedling. You couldn't buy it at the grocery store as a plant, you know, just like as an herb. You couldn't get it at the farmer's market. The only way to get it would either be to, you know, put it in your pocket at the Vietnamese restaurant where they served it to you with your pho, or grow it yourself from seed. And I wanted it so badly that I just kept trying. And in some ways, that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. Cause like you said, with lettuces, there are so many lettuces that are so good, way beyond what you can get at the nursery.
Yeah. So you developed this first one. How quickly mm-hmm. do you ramp up and describe the different varieties of the seed pack? I know there's the six pack one, mm-hmm. and I think it's called the 6E seed pod, which is cute. Mm-hmm. And then you have a 12 one. So what's the biggest you make? And are these mostly aimed at a home gardener who's only doing, you know, I don't know, a certain number of seeds each year?
Yeah. So for now, it's definitely aimed at a home gardener. And we do two different styles. So the 6E and the 12 pack, like you said, which have individual cells, mm-hmm. which mimic a lot more what we're accustomed to getting at the nursery. Mm-hmm. We also make two other models, creatively named the square and the rectangle, because that's how they're shaped. And those have one kind of open tray in them instead of cells. Okay. Because I remember when I was first doing this, I encountered a lot of gardeners with very passionate opinions on both sides that seedlings definitely for sure need to be in individual cells to keep their roots separate so that you don't tease them apart. And other gardeners who say passionately, for sure, you cannot restrict the roots of seedlings. You must let them roam free and then tease them apart later. I am agnostic on the issue, and I have had good results both ways.
Yep, me too.
So We have both varieties, both kinds of trays. And then the ones that also the rectangle and the square, because they have one shallow tray, are really good for microgreens. So we also sell those as a kit for microgreens for people who just are kind of dipping a toe in and want, you know, a very contained project. You know, it comes with the soil and the seeds and the pot and the whole thing.
Right.
So you can do that. But I've started using those more for the kinds of seeds where they take forever to grow, like a lot of my native perennials, where the seeds are little itty bitty. And so you just kind of scatter a bunch of them on the surface and then tease them apart later.
Yep.
So those are our four models, and they come in various kit formations as well. And I'm going to put this teaser out here. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I have some new models in development that will be for larger scale, but I'm not there yet. So that's all I can say right now.
Okay, but good to know. So tell us, how are they being produced at this point? What kind of, you know, what is the chemistry, and then what is the production line for you of getting these pots made and available for ordering?
So every pot has two main components. There's the clay body itself, the terracotta, and then the glaze that goes on the surface. So those are two materials that are mixed and sourced separately. The clay body is actually a very simple recipe. It is based on a clay that comes from Ohio called Red Art, which is known to be just a very reliable terracotta clay, which basically means an earthenware clay that comes straight out of the ground, and it has a high iron content, which is what makes it red. Mm-hmm. And it's also what makes it strong at lower temperatures.
Okay.
We have to mix it with three things in order to get it fluid. So water, obviously. And then we use two different salts that are called deflocculants. So that was a new word to me when I was learning this. So
new to me. Good vocab word. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. So flock, like a flock of sheep, means to come together. Deflocculate means to push things apart. So it's a chemical that makes things repel one another and be more fluid without increasing the water content. So these salts help so clay particles, if you imagine them microscopically, are like little plates. They're like little chips. They're very flat and they're mostly hexagonal. And so when they are flocked together, they pack in really closely and they have charged ends, so they can charge together and turn into a gel and be very firm. And once you have deflocculant in them, they repel one another and they stack more like a house of cards so that they are more fluid. And so those two salts are called sodium silicate and Darvan, both of which are non-toxic in reasonable quantities. I mean, nothing is, you know, you don't want to eat any of these things, but sodium silicate, in fact, has even been studied as like a germination helper in some sorts of horticulture. So we put both of those two in to make it fluid. Most terracotta blends have barium carbonate in them as well, which helps to keep the surface more blemish free. But barium carbonate is also known as rat poison. Like, it's not good stuff.
Mm-mm.
Once it's fired in the clay, it's generally safe, but we just didn't want to have it around in the studio. So we reformulated everything to not use that. And we also just accept a certain amount of, it's just called scumminess, like a little bit of a white surface on the clay,
mm-hmm.
comes from not having barium carbonate in there.
Okay.
So we just said, you know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
So that's all that goes into the clay. I won't tell you the ratios because it took me about 6 months of developing the recipe to get it so that it actually works. And it's still a delicate balance because, as you know, as a baker, when you mix, say, flour and water, those chunks of flour where it kind of, you've got those dry balls of flour, it takes a while for them to break down. The same thing happens microscopically in clay. So over the days of mixing and using a batch of clay, those clumps break up and more surface area is exposed, and therefore the chemistry needs to change the more the surface area is exposed. So it's called colloid chemistry, and it's really very analog, and you kind of have to react to it day to day.
Yeah, I love it. And so do you do all of that in your own studio still, or do you outsource the forming and the firing at this point?
We do it all in-house. I mean, I personally am not doing it all anymore. I have a staff member who takes care of most of that. But yeah, it's all in-house. And in fact, all of the times that I've tried to outsource any of it, it's all gone horribly wrong. Because I started this thinking I was going to do my core competency, which is being a designer. And the way most designers work is, you know, you design something and then you have a manufacturing business manufacture it for you. And so you work on design and selling, which is what I thought I was going to do. But it turned out I had to also build a manufacturing facility because it's not really outsourceable.
I kind of like that, though. I really do. I like the not going to a massive scale. There's some integrity there and accountability. It's like knowing who grew your plants, who takes care of the animals that you might eat. You know, there's like a direct relationship that I think is very beautiful in that.
It is. Though I want to do a quick segue here as we talk about business and the integrity is... One of the reasons everything is plastic is that you're competing against people who are making things out of plastic.
Yep.
And so not only with a product like this, not only do you have to help people realize that there's a different way to approach seedlings, you know, and thinking about your relationship with how you get to starts to put in your garden, you know, you have to plan a little bit more, you have to start the seeds and all of that. It's also too, I mean, I am competing against plastic seed trays that cost like $6.99. And so I also absolutely believe in and love the integrity of seeing the bags of clay and knowing exactly where they come from. And also it's very expensive. So it's very much kind of a knife edge of how do you do the right thing while also staying sane and paying everybody a living wage. And also not charging, you know, $700 for a piece of pottery. So it's this real balancing act. And I think it was Yvon Chouinard of Patagonia who said that being conscious in business is a pain in the ass. You know?
It is, but I also believe in it. And what I mean by that is there are so many movements in our world that do mirror this. And I think it's important that those people who can be the ones who say, okay, I'm going to spend $45 on this times three so that I can grow my seedlings this way. Mm-hmm. And I support this human, I support this concept, I support this ethos in our world, and that is money well spent to me, especially if it means I'm not ordering something off Amazon that comes not only as a piece of plastic, but also in like 17 other pieces of plastic, because the only way we're going to get out of this mess we have created is to think and do differently.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, we can talk about packaging in a minute. But I'll give you the other part of the technical side of it, of where all the materials come from. So that's the clay.
Yep.
And then the glazes we also make in-house. And this is one of the trickiest parts because most low fire pottery, which terracotta is part of that, is fired once. Oh, it's called the bisque firing to make it firm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so to the point where it won't like dissolve if you get it wet. It's, you know, it's basically strong. And then it gets glazed and then it gets fired again. And also most commercial pottery is glazed with, it's either done at a really like almost robotic mechanized level, or it's done with spraying, like spray booth. And we did spray booth at first, but even though our glazes are as non-toxic as they get, silica is a main component of clay and glaze and is toxic to breathe in the air. So even with all the best filters and all the best spray booth technology, you know, I was still worried it was getting in the air, and I had a small daughter at the time and she would come to work with me. And I was like, we're just not going to have aerosolized silica anywhere, just full stop, which meant that then we had to figure out how to dip glaze our pots, which meant we had to do it before firing because we drill holes in them. It was a whole thing. So we had to reformulate the glazes to work in a single fire process, which of course also has the main huge benefit of using half of the energy because we only fire once. But then it's a different recipe because the porosity of a fired clay is very different than an unfired clay. So glazes formulated for already fired clay just slip off of unfired clay. They just don't stick.
Okay.
And they make all sorts of weird swirly patterns because they're not sticking nicely. They don't make a good coat. It's like, it's a whole, I mean, that was another probably good 6 months to a year of just chemistry and prototyping and really a lot of bad glaze before we got the process. But now our process is such that our glazes, we actually just use like little laundry tubs that we have for each size of the pot that they fit nicely into. And so we just fill a laundry tub with glaze and then just dip the pots right up to the line, pull it out, and that's it. So it works now, but it took a very long time.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. Anne Fletcher is the owner and founder and inventor behind Orta Kitchen Gardens ceramic self-watering Orta seed trays. They have a California-based brick and mortar shop, as well as an online shop and seed club. We'll be right back after a quick break to hear more about Anne's garden life and small business story. Stay with us. Hey, it's Jennifer again. You know, all it takes is one seed, right? One gardener, one seed, one person to start an idea that changes everything. Imagine a world where we are not creating more plastic pollution with every garden move we make. I think here of so many innovators before us, rethinkers, reimaginers. I think of Rebecca Burgess founding Fibershed to reimagine an environmental and economic world built on circularity without plastic in our fabrics. And I see that same beauty and elegance and perseverance here in Anne Fletcher's idea and in her manifestation of the Orta seed trays. These ideas are like gardening at its best, long thinking, and they take both time and tenacity, just like a seed. And I want to encourage them and support them and disperse them wherever I see them sprouting. We can reimagine a world wherein we ask better questions and grow better answers, right from our own gardens. Great gardeners, like you, like me, like Anne, like Rebecca. We're doing it everywhere we grow. Let's keep doing it. We're back now to our conversation with gardener and inventor Anne Fletcher of Orta Kitchen Gardens and their Orta seed trays. Anne's invention and design of these non-toxic ceramic self-watering seed trays is a marvel. And as we come back, Anne and I are discussing the specs of the seed trays and how you work with them as your seedlings grow.
They are, I should look. They're one, I think they're 1.5 by 1 square on the top and 1.5 deep.
You know, so they make a nice root system. You know, and because they are this terracotta, it's relatively easy to kind of scoop them out once their root system is firm and kind of binding at the bottom, mm-hmm. I have found. Yeah.
Yeah, and I learned all about air pruning, which I did not know about.
Oh, do tell.
When I started this. Air pruning is where the roots, they go out the bottom drainage yep. hole, and then they see the air. See, feel the air, and then they stop growing, which then spurs the plant to grow more roots. Because the one that went out and found the air is like, oh, nope, not that, grow more. And so the shape of the cells, they're very tapered,
yes.
You know, they're like upside down pyramids. So that I did that to make it so they would be easy to come out, mm-hmm. right? So they wouldn't get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
But the added benefit is that when a root hits the wall, it has a straight, it kind of grows on a straight line out the drainage hole to air prune instead of like your typical nursery pots have a flat bottom.
Yes.
Right. So the roots can go down and then go round and round and round.
Ah, so it's less likely to get root bound in there.
Exactly. Because they hit the side and go straight out the hole and then stop growing and then grow another one, which that was a completely by accident benefit. I was just working on, let's just keep them watered and keep them alive and also be able to get them out.
Yeah. Well, they work beautifully. I have not yet tried perennials in them. How long, when you're working with native perennial seeds, how long do they stay in the seedling pot before you pot them on or put them out into the ground, Anne?
So, I mean, it depends very much on your plant, right? Like lupins are fast, but let's see, which ones have I done? So I did a lot of Anise hyssops recently, which are perennials. I don't know, actually know if they're, I think they're North American natives, aren't they? Or am I making that up?
No, I believe they're native to the Southwest. Yeah, not to California, but the Southwest.
And those ones were tiny, tiny, tiny seeds. And they took forever to germinate. And to, I mean, they germinated relatively quickly, but they were like, you know, the size of like a sesame seed. So to get to the point where they needed transplanting was probably a good month of, you know, itty bitty little plants. And then once I transplanted them, they really took off. But those ones, I think, and you can maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but for the rest of the country, I'm not sure how it works. But here in the Bay Area, the best time to transplant perennials is in the fall. And so basically, I just started all of those seeds in like late June, early July. And then I just, some of them were still kind of little. You know, they were only 6 or 8 inches tall when I planted them out in October. And other ones had, they were growing really fast through the summer and were, you know, 10 inches tall. And I'd had to pot them up multiple times. So it really depended. I kind of was just keeping an eye on them and transplanting them as they seemed to kind of outgrow their space.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I haven't tried with the pots yet, Anne, is bottom heat. Have you used bottom heat with the pots? And I would imagine that once it warms, it holds it just fine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I bottom heat all the time with peppers and tomatoes. I can get a tomato to sprout without bottom heat, but it takes a while. I simply get zero germination with peppers without heat. So yeah, I do. I set up a little indoor area in the laundry room on a heat mat where the things that need the most heat get to be closest to the middle of the mat. And then some things kind of just are a little bit right on the edge of the mat. But it's peppers and tomatoes that I give the highest priority to.
Yeah. And do you just put the ceramic pot right on that heat mat and it holds up fine? Mm-hmm. Great. Okay.
Yeah, totally. No problem. Oh yeah. These guys get fired to, you know, 1800 degrees.
And any tips on, you know, how you store them when you're not using them for seed starting? Any care and cleaning recommendations for, especially if you are working with natives and you have any concern, and maybe wild collected seed, if you have any concerns about passing, you know, any pathogens or whatever, how do you sterilize in between seedings? Give us some maintenance tips.
Yeah. So, the biggest danger to anything, porous and ceramic is water, either freezing or boiling.
Okay.
So it's like pipes, right? Like if you leave your water in your pipes and the water expands, it can burst. So if you live anywhere that it freezes, you definitely do not want to store them outdoors because they will, the water, the moisture in them will freeze and expand and break the pots. Same goes for steam. So you do not want to heat them over boiling point where there's any chance that they have any moisture at all. And in fact, that's a big part of our firing process is getting them as dry as we can. And then a couple of hours in the kiln to just make sure there's absolutely no water in them before we heat it up past boiling.
Okay.
So the way to sterilize is either to just embrace the water 100% and put the pot completely submerged, like in a pot on your stove and simmer it for about half an hour to an hour. So, because 180 degrees Fahrenheit is enough to kill most pathogens just under boiling. Yep. And that's kind of like a light simmer. So a rolling boil just risks mechanically breaking something, but a light simmer is hot enough and will, you don't risk boiling. A thermometer is great if you have one, just to make sure that you don't go over about 180. And the other thing you can do is put it in an oven, also at about 180 for about an hour.
Okay, good.
And usually the warm setting on an oven is between 170 and 190. But if your oven is a little iffy, you know, you should do it with a thermometer, or maybe use like a toaster oven that's perhaps a little more precise.
Yep. Okay, good. Good advice.
And then also to no bleaches, no disinfectants at all, because they'll just get absorbed into the terracotta and stay there.
Oh, and you do not want that leaching out onto your seeds.
Mm-mm, you do not, because it's not like plastic where it's non-porous, right? Where once you rinse it off, the chemicals are gone.
Right.
So no bleach, no detergents.
Excellent to know. Okay, good. When you look back, you've been at this now for 12 years. You're hitting 13 years, just about. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
2011,
yep.
2024. When you look back, what are you most proud of in this work and the results it has now grown into? You have the pots, you have the seed club, you have the advocacy, you have this model for a business that is living up to a world you want to see thrive.
You know, to me, what really keeps me going with all of this is when customers write to me and say things like, I never thought I could start my own tomatoes from seed, but now I do it all the time. Or I used to think lettuce was just this boring thing from the grocery store, but now that I'm growing all these new varieties, it's opened a whole new world to me. And so when I'm feeling like this is a lot of work, this is just, you know, I have a lot of boxes to ship, I've got a lot of quality control to do, there's a dirty shop that just needs organizing and inventory, you know, all the kind of day-to-day stuff that just kind of makes me go, ugh. Just thinking back to these emails and getting them from customers, it's like, yeah, that's why. That's why we do this. It's very gratifying to know that these products are making a difference to people.
Are there any challenges that you have faced or maybe continue to face that you would like to share with listeners as a kind of learning curve story that might grow them too?
Yeah. So there's a couple of them that I can say, you know, the challenges of the technical side of things were real.
Yeah.
Like it was a big deal at one point. So we mix our clay in a 55-gallon metal drum that has a mixer on top. And one of the first times we made a batch of clay in that mixer, it was in the evening and it was getting on towards winter. So it got dark early and we would mix it out in the parking lot because of the dust. Because at the time we didn't have a good dust collection system to do it indoors. So we would kind of put the powdery clay in outside and just run the extension cord and then wheel it back in. And we learned that day that clay can be over deflocculated, which means you've put too much of the stuff in that makes it liquidy. And at a certain point, the curve goes the other way and it makes the clay solid. So all of a sudden everything jammed and we couldn't mix it anymore. And we had, you know, a 55-gallon drum completely full of clay. And it's getting dark. And I was pregnant with my daughter at the time also. And we tried to wheel, kind of going, oh God, this is a total disaster. What are we going to do with 55 gallons of clay that has basically been ruined?
Oh.
Eventually we figured out how to not throw it away. We had to dilute it, variety of things. It worked in the end. But at the time we thought, you know, this is a whole batch of clay, a whole day's work gone, all the materials wasted. And we're wheeling it back into the shop to close the door and the wheels broke.
Oh.
And it tipped over and jammed against the door.
Oh my God.
And I think it, you know, weighs like 400 pounds or something. And you just look at that and think like, okay, I'm done.
I'm done.
This
yeah.
is it. And you take a minute and go, okay, well, at least it's jammed against the door and it didn't fall down.
Right. And it's not all over the floor, right?
Not all over the floor, right? You know, and so then we took shovels and buckets and emptied it. into a bunch of 5 gallon buckets and stacked them all up and wheeled it in and came back and tried again the next day and eventually solved it. And, you know, over and over again, I can't tell you how many bad glazes I've made and how many bad batches of clay, that technical problems do eventually yield when you just keep working on them. And so that's that. Those are the big challenges that have definitely been overcome over the years, to the point now where, like, when Vitellia, who is the person running production, you know, she calls me if she has a technical problem, and it's usually a problem I've already had. It's like I always say, you have to have all the problems, and I've had so many of them at this point that I've got a really long list of solutions. So there's that. And I would say the ongoing challenge, and maybe someone out there is in a place to help or give advice or to at least commiserate. It's the business side. Like I said before, you know, when I was thinking about drip irrigation, the business doesn't come as naturally to me as the engineering and the kind of thinking about how the system should be. But, you know, day-to-day administration and efficiency and kind of keeping the wheels on in a business way is a challenge. And so I'm right now thinking about, how do I grow the business with a partner or with a manager or somebody whose brain works that way?
Yeah.
You know, somebody who, for whom kind of a well-oiled machine business sense is like, that's what they do, but they'd like to do it in a context of, you know, living your values, right? Like, not necessarily doing it to bring more plastic in the world, but bringing that same sort of organizational business savvy to, you know, products made from terracotta that are shipped without any plastic at all, right? Because it's a different way of thinking about it, because you can't just order the, you know, we don't use any bubble wrap. We don't use any plastic packaging. We've got all these kind of weird supply chains of how do you ship fragile things without plastic. And, you know, so it's complex and it's an interesting challenge, but it's also not one I'm particularly suited to. So I kind of struggle with that one every day still.
Yeah. And it's, you know, even after 12 years to know that you are still learning, still experimenting, I think that is a little daunting, right? That it's still this case, but it's also affirming that if anybody else is out there listening who has started a small business and is, you know, it's the reminder of just try one more time, just try one more time, just experiment one more way, get another person's eyes or thinking on it, especially if they think differently than you, and be aware of your own limits and challenges and get support. You know, I think those are all important messages to our creatives who are trying to innovate us into a better world.
Yeah. And I think there's a real place for business people whose minds go towards organizations and, you know, standard operating procedures and financial documents, that whole world is very dominated by, you know, the kinds of worlds that I worked in before, right? Of, you know, getting the cheapest cost and the plastic stuff. And I think there's a real need for people who have that skill set to help out the folks who are, who kind of have the innovations and have these new products, but aren't necessarily all that good at building institutions around them.
Yeah. Yeah. Good points all. Okay. So for the last plant-based question, Anne, if you had five plants that you would not want to live or garden without as you look forward in your life, and that you can start from seed in an Orta seed pot, what would those five plants be?
Lettuce.
Which one?
Hands down.
Which one?
Oh, I only get one. I don't get a whole category.
Well, it would have to take five. So you only have five plants. You got to pick one species.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I don't get five categories. Okay. I would go.
If we'd be here all day.
We would. Okay. My kind of easiest go-to lettuce, I would say, is brown gold ring. I like that one a lot.
Okay.
It's very, It would be a tomato, which lately, so there's this project run by Steve Peters and Kanti Agarwal, where they're breeding tomatoes for California that are amazing. I would say probably Chocolate Silk was my favorite last year. I could eat that one forever. Ms. Spoona is a green that's a cross between tatsoi and mustard greens that is delicious and is like impossible to kill. So that one is just always in my garden. Oof, gosh. Some herbs. I would probably say basil. I would do a Thai basil. I'm up to four now, aren't I? Kale. I do madly kale because it's the easiest to grow and it has huge leaves.
Okay. I love it. I love it. Thank you very much for being a guest on the program today and for your innovative, creative, and generative work in our realm. And it's been a pleasure to speak with you. And I love my ortopots.
Thank you. Well, and thank you so much for having me on the program. I'm really honored to be here amongst all of your wonderful guests that you've had. It's fabulous to be part of your group. Thank you.
Ann Fletcher is a gardener, inventor, designer, and small business owner. Under the name of Orta Kitchen Gardens, she has designed and fabricates her ceramic self-watering Orta seed pots. These are Ann's efforts at reimagining our garden world without plastic or toxic side effects. Join us again next week when, as the migration and nesting seasons continue for so many of the animals that live in symbiosis and synergy with our plants and gardens, we revisit a best of episode with the Hummingbird Monitoring Network. That's next week, right here. Listen in. Cultivating Place is a co-production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio, licensed to Chico State Enterprises. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by listeners just like you through the support button at the top right-hand corner of every page at cultivatingplace.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. Cultivating Place is also made possible through the generosity of the Cato Shaw Foundation. The Cultivating Place team includes producer and engineer Matt Fidler, tech and web support from Angel Hiracha, and weekly show transcripts by Doulis Transcription. We're based on the traditional and present homelands of the Machupta Indian tribe of the Chico Rancheria. Original theme music is by Ma Muse. Until next week, enjoy the cultivation of your place. I'm Jennifer Jewell.